My name is Søren Michael Christian Bisgaard. I was born in Denmark and received three given names besides my surname. And later on in life, I came to India where I took sannyas and got the name Swami Kailasananda. Much later in Japan, I got the name Soen as a tea name and kind of title.
So you first came to India and then you went to Japan. When did you come to India?
I went to this part of the world first time in 1965 and came again and again in the following years. And in 1973 I was in Cork and decided to go to Japan.
Did you then?
And it took 3 years before I reached.
Why?
Because it was not so easy in those days and I didn't have money. I was accustomed to traveling overland between Denmark and India. Flying was completely out of the question. So you could not go overland to Japan, so I needed to make some money. Also, I wanted to prepare myself because I understood Japan would be quite different from everything else I had experienced until then. So I enrolled in Copenhagen University and studied Japanese for 3 years and other things, and then I arrived one autumn day on the 15th of October 1976. I was flying in on Aeroflot from Moscow and it was completely overcast. However, when I looked out of the window, I saw something protruding from the clouds, Fujisan. So that was my first glimpse of Japan.
What drove you away from India to Japan? What was your idea of...
So I had already spent much time and all my focus had been on India for many years. And I felt I had, well, kind of achieved what I could in India. And I had long had an interest in Japanese aesthetics and the Japanese traditional lifestyle, especially as it's defined by the tea culture of Japan. And I felt that a natural step forward would be to go to Japan and check it out.
And are you still in Japan?
I've been living in Japan ever since I arrived. Of course, I've been outside Japan many times since then. But basically, I've been living in Japan since 1976.
And were you immediately involved in the tea ceremonies when you arrived?
You could say so, because already I spent the first night in Kyoto. And the second evening, I was introduced to a Canadian guy who was living in the neighborhood. And he was already studying tea at Urasenke, the largest tea school in Japan. And within a week, I had been introduced. And after a while, I decided I would enroll as a full-time student. At first for 1 year, and actually it was a 3-year course, and it was 5 days a week, theory in the mornings and practice in the afternoons. After I graduated, I continued my studies, and 17 years later I received my final diploma and could begin to teach.
What did you do in Japan to earn your living, your livelihood?
So I came with a little bit of saved up money. As it happened, I had come to know a Japanese lady in Copenhagen, and she had met a Dane at the World Exposition in 1970, and married this Danish guy, and they had a little son who was just turning 1 year around that time. And as it happened, we had tickets to the same flight and flew to Japan together. And my Japanese was not very good. There were no foreigners in Kyoto at the time. Nobody spoke any English, and I was quite at a loss. So I spent much time with this lady, and she was an expert on spending my saved up money in nice restaurants and other places. So I was soon forced to find some source of income. So I had only a landing permit, which lasted 3 months. And after the 3 months, I went 1 week to Korea in the middle of winter. And returning from Korea, I decided, now I have to make some money. So I put up some posters in different places about English teaching. And soon after, I began teaching English. And then a couple of months later, I began translation work from English to Danish of kind of manuals for electronics and all kinds of things. That became a very good source of income. Later on, I did all kinds of things and traded in different things and so forth. However, I was not so successful. I was not a businessman. And things have only really gone well since I decided to make money on tea. Teaching tea and making tea parties to order and so forth. And then I could stop doing other things. So now everything I do is basically oriented towards tea and around tea. I also trade in tea. So I sell tea abroad, outside Japan.
So if you are in Japan and you say your focus is on doing tea and tea ceremonies, with whom and to whom and whom do you teach?
Mainly Japanese. Almost exclusively Japanese. There are occasional foreign guests, there are occasionally foreign students. But basically it's all to Japanese.
How comes that the Japanese people and the Japanese students accept a Westerner teaching them their traditional way of tea ceremony?
So, I am of course an outsider in that society. You really feel you are. They call it gaijin, an outsider, somebody who doesn't belong. However, I have studied under the most fortunate circumstances that very, very few Japanese will ever have a chance to do. So I have a better education than most so-called tea teachers in Japan. And they understand that, they can see that, and they appreciate that. And for my tea parties, they are somewhat different. They follow exactly the same pattern, the same rules and so forth. But I fill it with something else. And that something else is something I brought with me from India. And they can feel that and they appreciate it, so they come again and again.
What is this something else?
So, when I left India, I had the formless with me, so to speak. But the formless has no form in itself, and very difficult to express. So in Japan, I found a form in which I could express it. And then I do express it, and they can feel that. So they don't experience that normally in a purely Japanese context, because the Japanese don't have it.
What brings you to Auroville?
I'm here to introduce Japanese tea ceremony and maybe Far Eastern culture and way of living and thinking and approach to life in general. This has been arranged by Jyoti, whom I originally knew as Eri Naoki, and we are very close friends. And fortunately, he was also able to bring some friends from Taiwan, and I could bring a Chinese lady who's also studying with me, who is an expert on Chinese tea, and a number of other people came, and all together we feel we did something, because we are many and we could have a large program, and I hope this will have some effect in the future.
Was this your first time in Auroville?
Yes, this is my first visit to Auroville. I was in Pondicherry a long time ago, I think in 1973, and have not really been to this corner of India since then. So this is my first visit.
So did you know about Sri Aurobindo and Mother before you went
of
to
course,
India?
Of course, I knew about that a long time ago.
Did you know that Mother had lived in India? In Japan?
No, I didn't know. I only found out after I got to know about Auroville and so on. So I read this little pamphlet that France has put together about her experiences in Japan. It's very interesting, and I can only agree with most of her observations and points of view concerning the Japanese. And when I look at her work here and some of her sayings and other things, I can see that the 4 years in Kyoto has made a very deep impression on this young woman's mind, and that she may actually have wished to transfer some of the things she learned and she appreciated in Japan to this place. And in that context, I feel we are following up on her work. I don't think there's ever been such an impact from Kyoto before as we have now. So besides our appearances in the auditorium, we have been conducting tea ceremonies in different places. A major one was a formal offering of tea at the Tibetan Pavilion, which was quite well attended early in the morning on the Lunar New Year. And then we have been conducting tea ceremonies here at Verity for quite a large number of people, and also teaching some very eager to learn citizens or people living here.
Is there any difference between your students in Auroville, the people who came in the last week or weeks, to your ceremonies or to your classes, other than to other Westerners you teach somewhere else?
So there is quite some difference, I would say. So I'm teaching in Denmark, for example, and I have quite many students there. I'm going 3 times a year. They are quite serious, and their background is basically a Western background. I have a few who have been in touch with India or who is still coming here or so forth. In Denmark, I notice a clear difference between those who have been in touch with Asia and those who have not. Those who are into meditation, whatever kind, or other forms of self-discipline, including martial arts, they have a much easier time and are much more receptive and are quicker to learn than those who have not been in touch with Asian culture or meditation and things like that. This is very clear. I also teach in Bali, and I've been doing tea in several other Asian countries, and it's very clear that the Asian people are much more open and receptive to what I'm doing. The most receptive have been the Balinese. They almost live in the same world on a daily basis, where everything is significant, everything has a spiritual significance and symbolism and so forth, so they immediately grasp what we are doing. And here in Oroville, of course, everybody knows something about spirituality. All of them have some meditation practice and so forth, so they are also receptive to these things.
How can you describe your experience in Oroville?
I have mixed feelings. There are things I like very much. I've especially met many very nice, kind, helpsome, smiling people. And several of them are doing nice things in the arts or otherwise contributing in a creative manner, which I appreciate a lot. I also have been looking at a very interesting architecture, and of course Mantra Mandir is standing out as a beauty, but also many other interesting buildings are here, and the way people are living and so forth, I find that very appealing and very interesting. One thing I don't like is the dusty roads of Oroville. It's a very serious problem, in my opinion. All members of the group has been complaining about irritation of the eyes and the throat. I myself can feel it almost in my lungs, and in, of course, in the nose and throat. Your clothes, wherever we go, there is this dust everywhere. It's not just along the roads that you see it. It's built high up into the sky. Everybody is breathing it. Everybody is drinking it. Everybody is eating it. And I'm sure it's detrimental to your health and to the ideals of Oroville. If I was living here, I would definitely do something about it. It's a very serious problem. And everybody would benefit if the roads were made better. So this... Well, the one thing that really stands out, that could be much better, and I cannot understand it's not been done a long time ago. Communication is also somewhat of a problem. Josie doesn't have a mobile telephone. None of us have one. We tried to get one, but couldn't get one, and so forth. And we've been living in spread out over the whole place, often moving from one place to another place, and it's been quite chaotic and very difficult to coordinate, and we spent far too much time on the dusty roads, waiting for each other, waiting for the taxis, waiting for this, waiting for that. So much time wasted due to lack of infrastructure. An infrastructure that Oroville ought to have. considering who is living here and the aims and ideals of the place. It's completely incomprehensible. Things are not in order. There may be minor things, you know, but these are the obvious, clear things. I'm not really in a position to pass any judgment. I'm not living here. I know almost nothing about anything. What I feel is lacking is a charismatic leader with a great vision and showing the way with a great self-sacrifice. I have the impression that too much time is wasted in talk, and I think more action is required. When I look around, I see many people of around my own age or a little younger. I'm turning 64 this year. And when I look at the time Orville came into existence, I can see that around the world similar things happened, and by the same people. I feel there are many old kindred spirits here, and that they had a dream. They made a big sacrifice. They really worked for it and tried to achieve something, like they have done many other places all over the world. The same generation, with the same aspirations, all believing, they are all born after the Second World War, all believing now everything will become good, we'll build a new and better world where we do all the right things and so forth, and uphold the highest ideals. And now it has reached this point. You still have some things to work on. The dream has not been materialized as it originally was envisioned. And when I look around, I'm missing the two next generations, or maybe three generations, that are gonna carry it on. They're not young people enough in this place compared to people who are already in retirement age. This is another serious problem. Who will carry this place in the future when those who first built it are no more? For that, some new inspiration is necessary, most likely in a personified in a charismatic figure who can attract and inspire and bring it further.
Yeah, okay. Michael?
I of course, I understand about Sri Aurobindo and Mother, but typically in every such thing as this, there will be some who carry on. And I don't see that particular person or a few who are really carrying it on. You need live people. You know, life on earth is live. You know, generation after generation, you know, nothing lives forever. But life itself is eternal, and it takes constantly new forms and refreshes itself and so forth.
Coming,
not least spirituality in India, it's a live thing.
What can tea contribute to Auroville? Well, how can your tea ceremony inspire Auroville and the Aurovillians?
Already the second day I was here, I was introduced to some potters. who've been working for many years, and they make many interesting things, and they wanted my comments, because they're trying to make tea bowls, and they're trying to make other things. And I come from Japan, which has a very strong and highly developed ceramic tradition. We use a lot of ceramics in tea. The best of ceramics in Japan are for tea. So they kind of turned to me in the hope that I had something to tell them. And I did have things to tell them, and I pointed out that this is like this, and something here could be better, or this doesn't work, or it doesn't function. So in Japan, they make a lot of things, a lot of crafts. Everything is made for a particular purpose. They may also have things that are made for multi-purpose. But most things have a very clear purpose. On top of that, they're beautiful. Here there are many beautiful things, but the purpose is not so clear. It's a little bit haphazard how it turns out and how it's going to be used. So that idea is not so clear. So I pointed out some of these things. And a close friend of mine, whom I met in Japan, an American, has since many years brought Japanese craftspeople to Gujarat to teach Indian craftspeople how to do things. So Japanese crafts are of a very, very high quality. I feel good about saying they're the best in the world. There are very few who make as fine things as they do. So their way of working with great precision and accuracy is reflected in very high quality things. And all of this is somehow related to tea. So we do everything in a highly disciplined manner and maintain certain standards. And I think many of these things could benefit not only India in general, but in particular Auville, and Auville, because of the nature of the place, would have a fair chance of adopting some of these things and bring them to fruition, and then eventually transfer them to the rest of India.
Only in crafts?
No.
Only in crafts or pottery? No. Or
so
also in a spiritual, philosophical way?
So the Japanese are not so conscious when it comes to spiritual things. Many of them have several religions simultaneously. There is no conflict or anything, and they take it very lightly. The Japanese are more superstitious than they are what we would call religious. However, they have an attitude and outlook on life, and especially their relationship to nature, to form, design, and the material world, which is quite unique, and they're very sensitive on these points. And we can learn a lot from them on these points. At the turn of the century, from the 19th century to the 20th century, many Europeans went to Japan. It resulted in Impressionism. It resulted in Art Nouveau. It resulted in a new style of architecture, first in America and, for example, in Denmark. It was taken up seriously and made a complete and total revolution. At the same time, Danish furniture makers, they adapted the Ming furniture from China. Danish silversmiths of the searches and later all learned from the Japanese, and there is a constant stream of craftspeople, whether it's textile or ceramics or metal works or whatever, from especially Europe and America, coming to Japan to study. And they all learn something, also about forms, and they bring it back and they make better works.
So this is one could... Is this the idea of bringing to Auroville? Because that was my question. What offer to Auroville, also in a philosophical way, not only for the craft?
Yes, so I think the way we work and the way we do things is different from the way things are done here. And I think our way is superior. Because you can see it on many of the results.
Do you think you could convey something of your superior way to Auroville during your stay here with your ceremonies?
We have had very good response on our tea ceremonies. People have been quite impressed, especially by the precision and self-discipline displayed. So this is clearly lacking here. You may have a rich inner life, but on the material side, certain things are clearly missing. So in Denmark, I've been teaching people who had no previous experience or anything. So they begin studying tea already after a few lessons. The way they wash the dishes, for example, is changed. The way they do a number of things are changed. One of the first things I usually do is to the beginning student that just arrived, we're going to take a walk. So they look at me, you know, and wonder what's happening. So I bring along a pair of scissors and we go out searching for flowers in nature. So most people in Denmark, they only buy flowers in the flower shop, bouquets that are not so interesting, and displaying them en masse like that. And then I show them flowers in nature. There are lots of them there, which they pass every day, but they never noticed. And several of them, so I teach them how to arrange, select them carefully, not to take more than you need, resolve the problem of hurting the plant with yourself and God and so forth, and then to bring it to the tea room and make a very simple flower arrangement. So many of my students, they begin doing that, and their whole understanding of nature has changed. They suddenly see a lot of things they never saw before. And the practices of the tea room reflects on their daily life. They become more orderly, more systematic, and have a greater awareness of their entire environment, and have a better overview of their daily life, and little by little spreading out over greater expanses of both time and space. This is a direct result of practicing tea. So this is I wouldn't call it spirituality, but it means there is a mental transformation that's taking place that enriches their lives. They become more sensitive, see more, experience more, and they become also more open to their fellow beings, and they have more control of their own lives and their daily life and the whole thing. This is a direct effect of studying tea ceremony. I see the same thing in Japan, everywhere. And this could also be of benefit to the Orwellians.